You are listening to The Morning Magazine for Monday, August 2nd. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, as the Delta variant fuels a surge in COVID cases nationwide, COVID testing sites are returning to the landscape. I dropped by one over the weekend to see how easy the process is. And Denver City Council will vote tonight on a historical designation for the La Alma Lincoln Park neighborhood. We'll get the full story from our friends at CityCast Denver. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the latest Jim Hightower commentary just after the BBC headlines. And then it's a public affair with Frank Dubovsky. Today, he'll be speaking with Boulder County Commissioner Claire Levy about current issues facing the county and what it's like to be a county commissioner. And as always, on Monday morning, it's Counterspin at 9 a.m. A look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. But first, these headlines with KGNU's Jamie Sudler.
People who have not been vaccinated against COVID-19 will be required to continue wearing masks in medical facilities, homeless shelters, jails, and prisons. On Saturday, state health officials extended the statewide mask mandate. In a release, a spokesperson for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment said the prevalence of the Delta variant, together with the fact that many Coloradans are not fully vaccinated, is threatening progress in the state. Now, the mask mandate, which was expected to expire in June, will be in effect until September 1st and could be extended again. While the rule exempts children under 11 years old, state officials are recommending that everyone in school settings should wear masks, especially those who are not vaccinated. CDPHE officials released their latest policy update for schools on Friday evening. The state is permitting each school district in Colorado to set its own mask policy. Chalkbeat reports that some districts around the state have already adopted a range of masking policies. Jefferson County schools will require masks for children 11 and under and unvaccinated older students. Teachers and staff will also have to wear them. In Aurora schools, masks will be required for unvaccinated staff and strongly recommended for unvaccinated students. In the Adams 12 five-star district, all teachers and staff will be required to wear masks and are optional for students. In Littleton, Douglas County, and Mesa County's District 51, masks will not be required for anyone. While some districts have issued policies, many in the state have not yet done so, including Denver, the largest in the state. Boulder County health officials recently announced plans to provide guidance in early August to the Boulder Valley and St. Vrain Valley school districts on masks and quarantine policies for this fall. On Friday, Governor Jared Polis said that state employees who are not vaccinated against COVID-19 will have to be tested twice a week for the virus and also will have to wear masks in the office. In a statement, Polis called his decision a middle-of-the-road approach in an attempt to respect those on both sides of the vaccination debate. The Colorado Sun reports it is also in line with rules announced by President Joe Biden for federal employees. The governor said he had heard from state employees who are terrified that unvaccinated co-workers will give them the virus and they wanted vaccines to be required. But he also heard from some who have hesitation in getting inoculated. Those required to get tested will not have to pay for them. About 30,000 state workers are affected by the requirement, and it applies only to those in the executive branch and not those who work for the courts and the judicial branch. Polis added that he also encourages all eligible residents, including state employees, to get vaccinated, saying it's highly effective against the Delta variant. At least one business in Boulder is planning to ask patrons to show proof of vaccination against the COVID-19 virus. The Daily Camera reports that Dakota Seufer, the owner and chef at Cafe Aeon, says it's a chance for them to be proactive instead of reactive when the outdoor patio can no longer be used. The head of the Boulder Chamber of Commerce told the camera that it's the first business in Boulder he has heard of that is planning this type of policy. However, there may be others. The owner of Aeon said that all of his employees have been vaccinated, and he will be working with staff to determine how the vaccine requirement will work. The Boulder Planning Board has voted not to recommend the approval of the CU South Annexation Agreement, which was negotiated between the city and the University of Colorado Boulder. If annexation of the more than 300-acre property near US 36 and Table Mesa Drive into the city is approved, it will be the site of the South Boulder Creek Flood Mitigation Project. According to the Daily Camera, while not supporting the agreement, the board also forwarded recommendations to the City Council, which it hopes will be considered when it assumes authority over the agreement tomorrow. Those recommendations include more details about open space, development, water, and natural resources. About 700 residents of the Elyria-Swansea neighborhood of North Denver have been without natural gas service for days. Xcel Energy had been working since the middle of last week to fix a gas line that was damaged. KDVR reports that many of the people who live in the area said that they didn't receive any type of notification from Xcel that the gas would be turned off. As of late Saturday night, some people hadn't had their service turned back on, but hundreds still hadn't. The area has been heavily impacted by the work on I-70. However, the Colorado Department of Transportation said in a statement that the gas problem was outside their area of work. Xcel Energy provided food for residents from taco trucks, and they were also told that Xcel would be setting up portable showers. CDOT hopes to open Interstate 70 through Glenwood Canyon today, but no definite date has been given. Crews worked since late last week to remove mud and debris. On Thursday night, dozens of drivers were caught in the mud and had to be rescued. More rain is expected in the area this week, which could lead to more mudslides. And in today's metro weather area, it will be partly sunny with areas of smoke and highs in the mid-80s and a chance of showers and storms this afternoon and into the evening. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy in Boulder with a chance of showers before noon and becoming likely in the afternoon. Right now, it's about 61 in Boulder and Fort Collins and 66 in Denver. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. The highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus is fueling a surge in cases nationwide. While vaccines do protect against severe cases of COVID, evidence is mounting that even vaccinated individuals can become infected and infect others. Case rates have been thankfully low in the highly vaccinated Front Range region for weeks, leading many testing sites to close due to decreased demand. But that may be changing. Over the weekend, I happened upon a new pop-up testing site in downtown Boulder and recorded these interviews. I'm here in the Central Park next to the Boulder County Farmers Market. Here with, what's your name?
My name is Jennifer.
And what group are you here with?
So we are with Community Wellness America. We're doing the free COVID testing. It's actually under the umbrella of the COVID bill. So basically, the Community Wellness America went to the COVID bill with a grant, which is, already has like $2.3 million set aside for COVID testing, and they got some of that grant money. So we're doing it here. We're doing it. There's places in California, in Washington, Oregon, Texas, Florida. There's different nonprofits that had gotten grant money to have these free COVID test pop-up sites.
And is this the first time that you've set up a pop-up site?
Yes. This is our first time. And I've been coming here, like, to the park. This is my third time I've come to this park. And then I was like, we better do the farmer's market. Let's see what happens. And there's just been a huge spike that's happening in California. And so we're really concerned. That's the picture of a current picture that was just sent to me. I'm actually going out there tomorrow to help. And I'm going to have my team members do the testing here while I go to California.
So this is for radio. So you're showing me a picture of a very, there's a long line. It's an outdoor pop-up site, has a small tent, has a couple of people who are performing the tests, and there's definitely more than 12 people in that line. What has been the response here in Boulder?
So what we're seeing are a majority of the people are using it for travel. So are they either coming here or they've just got, or they're leaving and they need it for travel. That's been the majority. But however, unfortunately, there also is this Delta variant that's been showing up. And whether you're vaccinated or not, you should be getting tested. I'm seeing, as a tester, people that are coming out positive that are vaccinated.
Yes, but
so we really just want to, there's no harm in getting tested and making sure we test the results to you in 2 to 3 days. We're going to be having rapid tests as well. And about probably by this time next week, we're going to have rapid tests. So we'll be doing the PCR and the rapid. So that's really awesome. We're really excited about that. But testing is really the only thing that we can really do to know for sure that we can, you know, help to control this. Otherwise, it's kind of like an all-of-the-above situation. You know, people go, well, what if I'm vaccinated? It's all the above. It just depends on the person. So, but as a test, that's the scientific concreteness that we need to kind of help get a hold on this again.
And it's around 2 p.m. on Saturday. How many people have come through today?
So we've already done about 40 tests today, and we just got set up at like 11, I think it was. So we've been doing quite a few tests. We're really happy to be here and serving the community in this way.
Have any people had symptoms, or is it just pure curiosity?
Not so much curiosity. I would say more people that are traveling, but they're, you know, they also may have just received, I had one guy that had just received a text message saying that there was someone on the plane that tested positive. So he was like, I want to get tested just to make sure. I had some people with some sore throats, but other than that, it's mostly people that are non-symptomatic.
And I've seen people are administering the test to themselves, putting the swab up their own noses. How do you do this for kids? Is there like a down the throat or a saliva test, or with kids it also has to be up the nose?
So the kids, they tend to kind of like to do it themselves. They don't have to go all the way back unless the parent wants to do it. But they just have to, it's a self-administered test, and you just have to make sure to get, I try to get people to kind of sneeze a little bit through their nose, blow some air through their nose to bring some mucus down. But it's not something that you have to go all the way up into the back of the brain or anything like that.
And have any kids come through here? Because, of course, the kids are not vaccinated. Exactly. The ones that are under 12 years of age are not eligible for vaccines. And this Delta variant has been shown to be a bit more harmful to kids. What has been the reaction with children?
Actually, I had a little girl that asked her mom that she, you know, this morning that wanted to get tested. And she was really excited to be doing it. And it was kind of cute. But she didn't have any symptoms. So, but like I said, you can still be carriers. But, yeah, so you can, as long as you have a parent or guardian, anyone under 18 can get a test, but otherwise they can't. Like a 17-year-old, we had a 17-year-old come up today, and unfortunately we couldn't test him because he didn't have his parent or his mother with him. So that's the only people that we can't test, if children are under 18 and don't have a parent or guardian. But otherwise they can test as well.
What are the logistics as far as costs, the turnaround time for results, how people get their results from a pop-up tent?
So we get the text messages, and that people get their results within 2 to 3 days. Of course, with the rapid test, they're going to get it within 15 once we start carrying that. And they can be, you can be even out of state, out of country, and still get a test here. And we can also do it, we can get the results to you by email. Just have to print that properly, because a lot of times we have problems seeing the actual email because people write it down so fast. But we do prefer the text. And we get them, the turnaround's about 2 to 3 days. So, and it's a very accurate PCR test that we're doing as well.
Is there any need to show proof of insurance, proof of identity?
We do want a driver's license just to help legitimize what we're doing so we can receive more grant money. However, we will test people that do not have IDs or driver's license, or and definitely if they don't have insurance, that's fine too.
Can I give myself a test just to see how
Absolutely.
It works? All right, let's do it. I've never shoved a PCR up my own nose before, so here we go.
So we're going to just go ahead and have you fill out this information. I just sanitized that pen for you. Do you guys want to get tested? Come on over here. I love your tunic.
Thank you. Are we allowed to if we're from out of state?
Absolutely.
Okay. Could I give you guys a quick interview? I'm with KGNU. What's your name? And we're here at the COVID pop-up site. Why are you getting tested?
We came to farmer's market and having lunch. We're coming from Missouri, which is high cases, and thought we'd get tested.
Do you have any symptoms or any reason? It's just a, you know, precaution.
Not really. She's going to school in a few weeks. Had fatigue and headache, but that's
about it. Cool. Do you want to state your name?
Tracy Reynolds.
Okay. What part of Missouri?
Kansas City. Outside of Kansas City.
Okay. And why did you come to Boulder? Just
travel.
Tourism?
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Stick it in an inner tube.
And you're going to put it down, swab down. Perfect.
Okay. So there's no, like, refrigeration or anything necessary for these? You just stick it into the cooler?
Oh, no. I got to keep them cool.
Okay.
So, yeah, I have ice blocks in here. And then I have to drop these off tonight at the airport. They actually fly down to San Diego. They want them all at the same lab.
Okay.
They go to Crestview in San Diego. And then
we
give
you
one of these.
Today.
No, we don't have the we don't have the rapid test quite yet. We will very, very soon, though.
Okay.
I don't think you identified yourself by your last name. Did you want to just leave it as first name basis?
Yeah, just first name.
Okay.
Fine.
All right.
We've already been vetted, by the way, by Denver Health and Denver Colorado Public Safety. So we're on 60th Street Mall as well, downtown Denver, if you need to come and see us. We're also down there as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much, Shannon.
Sure.
We now turn to our weekly partnership with CityCast Denver. City Council will vote tonight on a historical designation for the La Alma Lincoln Park neighborhood. It may not seem like a splashy, high-stakes vote, but it's important to many who live in the Chicano-majority neighborhood.
Denver City Council is voting tonight on what might look and sound like a small tweak to the zoning of the west side of Denver. It doesn't have a ton of major practical implications. It's not going to lead to any massive redevelopment projects or new construction, but it does mean a lot to many of the people who live there. They're voting on a proposal to designate the neighborhood of La Alma Lincoln Park a historic cultural district. It would be the city's second after Five Points, and it would recognize the neighborhood's long and diverse history, but specifically its key role in the Chicano movement of the 60s and 70s. We wanted to understand what that designation and that history means to the people who live in the neighborhood today. So we met up with a few community members at the La Alma Rec Center. Here's Kathy Prieto and her daughter, Desiree.
I was here clear back in the early 50s. I was born in 55. And I lived on 9th and Mariposa, 953 Mariposa, the Red Projects. We were just all around the West. I mean, this has been my home since. And this is where I brought my kids up. My mom was an activist. She was really a
part of the movement.
Yeah, she was. And she was really into what she believed, you know, for the people, you know. We even had Cheech and Chong out here 1 year. And
yeah,
it was like the Chicano Power. And
sure,
that's what we did, you know.
And her house is where you live now, right?
Yes, that was hers and my dad's. Back in the 60s when we moved in there, it was the gathering place and still is to this day. And they, you know, everybody knows John and Helen's house.
I'll just add to what my mother was saying. I was born in 1974, and I've been real close to my grandma and grandpa my whole life until they passed. Everybody hung out there. We all stuck together. Our family, for the most part, when we were younger, we all stuck together. I mean, this neighborhood has been through so many different phases and different things.
Yeah.
Some good, some bad.
Yeah.
Some you wouldn't even want to be here through.
When I was still at West, that was the riots in
sure.
the 60s, and we had police brutality. They hurt a lot of our men, our young men that would be walking around, you know, they carrying a can of beer or something, and they would get beat over things like that, you mm-hmm. know.
There were times when it was scary to be here. Like, bad things were happening here, worse than now.
When Kathy says West, she's referring to West High School, the site of the West High walkouts in 1969. Hundreds of Chicano and Latino students walked out of the school in protest of treatment by white teachers and administrators. The unarmed students were met by police in riot gear, and many young people in the community were injured and arrested. The walkouts were part of a larger movement for Chicano civil rights in the 60s and 70s that addressed segregation, police brutality, and unfair treatment of the community, many of whom resided in the La Alma Lincoln Park neighborhood.
How do you feel about it now?
It's nice. I miss the unity, because when I was little, you knew your neighbors, we all knew each other. So it's nice. Like, I love my mother's block, because the people there have made it a point. There's a few that have been there for a long time.
Yeah.
And everybody still talks to each other. That's not on every block, unfortunately. We're like family still, some
yeah.
of us.
Yeah.
My mom's neighbor that was there since, I think, before I was born, Lalo, he died from COVID, and it was like we lost a family member.
He was the strength of our neighborhood. Every time somebody needed work in their yard or in their homes, or he would come, "You need help? What do you need?" you know.
Yeah.
But, a lot of the new people that are moving in to our neighborhood, I think God has blessed us because they're not trying to change anything. They're neighborly. Change is okay.
Yeah.
But ask first. You know, don't take from us anymore. You know, let us make that decision.
Though it had been decades in the making, a few years ago, a movement to preserve the West Side's Chicano civil rights history picked up steam. This current cultural historic district designation being proposed is part of that larger movement to celebrate and preserve Denver's Chicano history. Here's another of the organizers, past CityCast Denver guest, Ian Thomas Tafoya.
Ian, how did you get involved with this historic cultural district project?
Well, I think I first heard about this project because I've been following along with Historic Denver, and I lived here in La Anima. And then I luckily became a board trustee of Historic Denver, and so this has been a project that has been really a labor of love. My family lived here in the West Side. I think we've seen a lot of displacement, removal of Latino people, and so, you know, just the saving of the culture has been really empowering. And when I lived over here, the art was the most empowering part for me. I had worked in the government. I worked in the situation where you were supposed to conform. You cut your hair, you can't wear jewelry, that kind of thing. And then you're here and you see this like powerful cultural context of men, I guess, bending the traditional gender lines in a lot of ways, as our culture would see it, but not mine. Talking about the police violence here in this community, I've witnessed so much police violence in my community.
And how old are you?
35.
Right. So that wasn't, it's not in the past.
Absolutely not. And really working on this has shown me so much more because they were saying every time 10 people wanted to come to the park and hang out, you know, that was the police coming and busting you up and beating you up if you were lucky. Sometimes there would be guns and violence. And I mean, we have to remember that there are many parks over here, Sunken Garden Parks, this park on the side, that said no Mexicans allowed except on certain days of the week. So full on segregation. And so, you know, the murals here, all of it is about reparations and reclamation.
What is preservation going to do for something like the murals or that culture?
I think it's very similar to the national park system in a lot of ways. You're creating a reason for people, inducing demand for the consumption of that culture and that heritage. You know, we've had a chance to do a lot of tours here now since this whole conversation began, just nationally. And I think it's incredibly relevant now because we've seen the zoning here on Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for people not to forget both the indigenous motifs, but also the importance of this space in the Chicano movement. For me, too, with the historic preservation, and, you know, we talk about climate crisis, right?
Yeah.
Well, the whole reason that Auraria, the real impetus to remove it was for the fact that there was a flood that degraded some of the properties, and that was used as an opportunity to displace urban renewal.
Right.
And urban renewal or gentrification, look at what they've done on I-70. And so I think there's a concerted effort by Chicanos, Latinos to protect our heritage on this side of town. I mean, truth be told, when I first started on the Historic Denver Board, I looked at the historic landmark map and the key was over Barnum. It was over the West Side. So if you're not even on the map, you're not even part of the conversation. You know, this action project by Historic Denver is hopefully the first of many.
Yeah.
And we've done a lot of work through the pandemic on our own diversity and equity, trying to tell more of the stories that are here. And I think the cultural district's great because it's flexible.
Yeah.
There's a lot more flexibility in it, and just from design standards, but still maintaining the culture. But I think a real perfect example, you know, the Landmark Preservation Commission has only white people on it.
Mm.
And so, you know, part of my remarks at that level were, you know, it's great that you're here and that you care about this, but part of the problem is that we're a dozen Latinos asking you to protect our heritage, and it's an all-white board that makes the decision.
The Landmark Preservation Commission already approved the Historic Cultural District designation in June, and the Planning Board endorsed it earlier this month. So the only step remaining is the City Council vote tonight. If they approve, certain buildings will be protected as landmarks that contribute to the culture. Plus, any homeowner hoping to do exterior alterations will have to go through a design review to make sure the changes are in line with the district.
I really hope and encourage the City Council to vote for this. I think, you can't just espouse values through rhetoric. It has to show up in policy and in projects and in zoning and in decisions. And this is a chance for them to get it right. And
yeah,
having sat on the Blueprint Denver plan, the, you know, the long-term 20-year vision for this city, I've really encouraged the city to think about historic preservation at the same time that they're thinking about expansion. Because
yeah,
the community's already together.
Right.
And for Kathy and Desiree, there's hope that this historic cultural district designation would encourage some of their neighbors and their homes to stay rooted in the community.
I'd like to keep a lot of our houses, a lot of our neighbors. We go outside and we talk about it, and they talk about fixing this and fixing that. And we ask it, are you ever going to leave? No.
Like, it's just the way it is.
I'm comfortable. I'm really comfortable. That's the only house all of our family know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it's in a really special neighborhood.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that does it for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to volunteer headlines producer Jamie Sudler and the entire crew at CityCast Denver.